Hello, fools and degenerates. This episode of the QTR Podcast is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are the fine folks that sign up and donate a monthly recurring sum through Patreon to help support the podcast. Real quick, I want to shout out some of the most prominent patrons, the people that help keep this podcast going. First are my friends over at Quantamize.com, Quantamize. Quantamize.com. They are an AI-powered platform that gives you access to over 10,000 stocks, options, and crypto. They've been named the number one alternative to the Bloomberg Terminal recently by Benzinga. There's a link to them in the podcast description, and as of right now, their entire service is free. So sign on. You got nothing to lose. Tell the old Bloomberg Terminal to take a walk, go fly a kite, go hang out over with my friends at Quantamize.com. Also, the podcast is brought to you by my friends over at Rumorhound. Rumorhound, R-U-M, oh, fuck me. Come on, stupid, you know how to spell it a first grade level. R-U-M-O-R-H-O-U-N-D, Rumorhound. They also have a link in the podcast description, and Rumorhound is an awesome innovative service that utilizes artificial intelligence to help you sift through which buyout rumors have credibility and which ones don't. When you hear chatter, when you see shit in chat rooms and you see shit on Twitter, Rumorhound is there to help you make sense of it all. They look at the source of the chatter, the source of the rumor, to try and give you the edge as to which rumor may or may not be worth investigating a little bit further. Finally, this podcast is also brought to you by my friends over at Hella Bacon. Hella Bacon are a bunch of American flag-toting Texans that like to shoot machines out of helicopters. I don't know what else to say aside from that, otherwise it sounds pretty insane and pretty badass, so there's a link to Hella Bacon in the podcast description too. I also want to really quick shout out my friends Nicholas Parks, who is a new patron that I appreciate, who's come up huge. My friends at Corvus Gold, my buddy Nathan Michaud, Chris Bede Kennar and Chris Boas, Russ Valenti and Piggly Wiggly, my friend Cool Death, who just signed on over the last couple days. I appreciate you. And some of my newest patrons, I'm talking about Paul Brennan, The Death of Rats, VJ Sampath, Mike Matazak, what's going on? Agnes Dobo, Chris Thomason, Alan Jaworski, Patrick Osgood, James Currian, Pennyman's in the house. Patrick K. White is back with me. I appreciate you. John Cooper, my homie Justin Vaccaro just checked back in. Piotr Pajicowicz, whatever. Samuel Pearson, William Davis, and CJ Carey. Born to Run, Robert Razagatis, and Raz Jan V. Oh, geez. Can you guys just put your fucking name down as John Smith? Please, this will make things a lot easier for me when I do this. And there go all of my patrons with long names. All right, I did my best, guys. Before we get started on today's podcast, just two other things you got to know. First, I am not an investment advisor. This is not investment advice. I hold no licenses, I hold no registrations, and basically do your research elsewhere. That's the only thing you need to know, folks. It's the motto of the show, aside from drink. But the other motto is DYRE. It stands for do your research elsewhere. Do your drinking here, but do your research elsewhere, ladies and gentlemen. Finally, there is a two-drink minimum to this podcast, which I encourage you to go beyond. Go beyond. Explore what happens when you have more than two drinks and you're listening to the podcast. And then write me a note and tell me all about it, because I'd love to hear about your feelings and things of that nature. Just actually deal with that with your therapist. Just send me your money on Patreon. We'll be fine without all the editorialization. I would appreciate that much more. All right. I have with me on the line, again for the second time in as many weeks, Mr. Dave Collum, who is an economic commentator. My words, not his. I don't think that's in his official bio, but to me, he's an economic commentator. He's also a chemist, the Betty R. Miller Professor of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Cornell University. You guys ever heard of it? He holds a little of the office joke for you. He holds a PhD from Columbia, a master's degree from Columbia, another some type of other degree from Columbia, a bachelor's from Cornell. The point is, he's doing very fucking well in the education department. Hello, Mr. David Collum. How are you today?
Hey, how are you doing? Long time no chat, huh?
I know. It's been 11 days, but it's felt like forever. So I wanted to have you back on because we got such an awesome response. And personally, I was enjoying speaking to you the last time I had you on. I didn't want to cut that short, but we went up against some time constraints. But I appreciated you coming on, and we'll kind of do a part two here today, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, sounds good. I'm told we might have broke the record you did with Peter Schiff. I think I spotted that in one of the comments.
Oh, did you? I actually, yeah, matter of fact, I can look right now and let you know if that's if we want to stoke your ego before we get started, that'd be a good way to do it. You know, it always
that just means I babble more. So that's an ego thing.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. Let me say, I think you're actually, I don't know how to pull up the stats. I like this too. When people that are like going to try and patron, they're like, oh, can I have the statistics? I'm like, I don't know how to fucking work the thing. You know, I got a microphone. I got a computer. I had some kid come over and set the whole thing up for me. I really feel old now. I had some young buck come over and set it up, and I don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
So how old are you, Chris? I have no idea.
I'm 36, so I'll be 37 in December.
So you're just a young punk.
I am. Dude, I got a million things I want to talk to you about. The first thing I want to ask about, before I even get into Christine Lagarde's comments and what that idiot on CNBC said today, I want to ask you about student debt, because I wanted to ask you about this the last time that you were on, and you are plugged into the university system, so I wanted to get your take on this plan that Elizabeth Warren has come out with here. And we did chat about Elizabeth Warren a little bit last time, where she says she wants to basically, if you're making under $100,000 a year, she wants to relieve you of $50,000 up to $50,000 in student debt. I just want to get your off-the-cuff take on that.
Oh boy, student debt, a lot of facets to that one. First and foremost, I challenge your readers to go boot up a plot of student debt. One of the things they'll notice is it's really linear. It is so linear that it looks algorithmically linear, and I've submitted several times now that student debt looks to me like a monetary policy. It looks like someone said, let's crank on student debt, just like they said, let's crank on a housing bubble. And so it's kind of a cash for clunkers program, right? So they gave students a whole bunch of money to go get a bunch of degrees, and it dumped $1.5 trillion into the economy. And somehow the monetary gurus think that's a plus. Warren's idea. So it's a very complicated problem, because on the one hand, I think the idea of giving people a break who can't afford it's a very good idea. If you go back to World War II, I'm now really ad-libbing. Go back to World War II, the GIs came home and they had the GI Bill, and that certainly was a plus. I think the motivation of the GI Bill was not to make America great or anything like that. I think it was actually the smart guys recognized that a bunch of soldiers were coming home and there would be no jobs. And so what they did is they said, well, we'll just absorb them into the university system. So I think they put out the GI Bill to make sure that unemployment didn't soar. That's my guess, my suspicion. So the problem I see with Warren's plan is multifold. One is that, and I don't know it well, so correct me if I blow this. If you're forgiving existing student debt, there's going to be a sense of unfairness to a lot of people too.
Right.
Now, I think the student debt problem is a profound one, because we've got a generation who have this yoke around their necks. And so I do think that it's an issue that's huge, but I don't know how to fix it. So you forgive student debt for a whole bunch of people, and the others are saying, well, what, I paid mine off. That's not fair. And so I think there's going to be some bad blood out there. Now, you know, we get over that, right? We give money away to all sorts of people. We send pallets over to Iraq, right? We get used to that. The second problem, the thing that bothers me more, is I'm inclined to believe that you could cut back the number of degrees being given in the country by a factor of two and not lose much, depending on, of course, how you do it. I think there's a lot of squandered time spent in college, and I'd really much rather see training, like in, well, a good example apparently is Switzerland, where they call out a whole bunch of people and teach them how to be craftsmen of various kinds, and so famous Swiss watch, right? So I think we're generating way too many degrees that are useless, and so we have, you know, majors that should be minors and minors that should be courses, and as I like to say, courses that should be history, And then if you take a bunch of kids who are, if you make college free, which, you know, anyone who could convince me they were going to go and bust their ass and really do something, I give it to them, right? I don't have a problem with that. But there's going to be just huge squandered resources. There's some horrific stories of of kids who do nothing all through college. And so I don't know how you get around that.
They're kids that don't even attend. They take their student loan money, which is provided to them in their bank account and not directly, you know, wired to the school as it should be. They take that money and they go buy a car and then they go mingle for a couple of years. They don't go to one class.
And then I saw a stat a couple of years ago, and I've cited this several times for several people, but one of the Texas schools, I think it's UT, University of Texas at Arlington, I think, I hope it's them because I'm about to shit on them, that actually could monitor their online reading assignments. Because, of course, algorithms are that smart. And so the kid boots up the thing and it starts the clock. But if it's not scrolling, presumably the algorithm's smart enough to recognize that it's just on a dead screen. So the algorithms can figure out how much the kids are reading. And the conclusion was is that they were averaging 162 minutes per semester. Now, I don't even know if that means per course or per entire curriculum, but it doesn't really matter. That school is serving no function.
Well, and not only that, but that 162 minutes isn't necessarily dedicated to reading. The probably 100 of that is reading, and 62 minutes on average is somebody sitting there with a Corona in his hand, socializing with people on one side of the room while using his left hand to reach over and scroll the feed down on the computer.
One-handed typing, right. One-handed typing. Somehow there needs to be skin in the game or there'll be huge squandering. You know, Cornell kids are unbelievably smart on average, right? Where we are seeing the top of the food chain here pretty close, and you still see waste. And so I can't imagine what it would look like. I think what happens is as you go down the food chain, you probably find more and more waste. And then I think you end up with an odd phenomenon where I think if you go to the community college, you then get a bump up again. I think the community colleges are populated by guys who are people who want to be there. And they're going out of their way to be there. And they have a plan. They're maybe learning how to do nursing or whatever, right? And so I would have to say that you really have to think hard before you start writing checks for student debt and think hard about before you start writing checks for student for tuitions in advance. Both have some merit and also have some real dubious qualities to them.
Why is it so difficult for people to understand that? All right, I know we talked about Maxine Waters at that congressional hearing a couple weeks ago, where she didn't even know that student debt had been nationalized back in 2009 or 2010, whenever it was. And she was yelling at the heads of the major banks, you know, like, why are you guys issuing so much debt? And they're like, we haven't issued student debt in a decade, you know? All right. So we understand that, you know, Congress doesn't really have a good understanding of the basics. But is it really that difficult to kind of hope that they would understand that when you are providing what is essentially unlimited government-backed funds for students to attend school, that universities are going to see that, they're going to hike their prices, right? They're going to lower the quality of the education. They're just seeing that as free money, whether or not the students come or not, you know, one way or another, for the most part, they're getting paid, right? So why doesn't the government understand that plan of trying to kind of open the sieve and let everybody go to college ultimately doesn't wind up in a better quality of education anyway? Like you're saying, there's a lot of useless degrees out there, right? People are taking on $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 in debt to go, you know, with a degree that they're not going to be able to use.
Yeah, I was at dinner the other night and was with a New York Times op-ed journalist, and there was some of my colleagues were there, and a classicist, right? This is the guy who studies Plato and stuff like that. A classicist was talking about, and first of all, our classes apparently are quite conservative, which is rather striking. But he was saying, you know, you can't ask these kids to take some moral high ground when you're charging them $250,000, $300,000 for the education, right? So this guy was making the argument that you know, students should be thinking more globally, blah, blah, blah. And he's going, we charge them too much. They got to think more specifically, right? They really got to get the job done here. And he was questioning that. You're assuming in your statements that Maxine Waters is A, not an idiot, which is a terrible, terrible assumption. You're also assuming that they're trying to get it right, and they're not, right? There's no evidence they are. There's not, I mean, all you have to do is watch what's going on in any given day. So they don't care if they get it right or not. It's all pure politics, right? So they don't care what happens. And you know, if somehow the students end up in some bad situation, they'll just turn it into a new political issue. So,
well, and that's already what's happening.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I wanna...
That's what we're seeing. So we're seeing the rise of socialism, and I'm not trying to be hyperbolic, because you could say, well, you know, forgiving debt is not socialism. No, it's a tame sort of front edge of it. We could see some real honest to goodness socialism, and I'm now seeing people out there saying, what's wrong with socialism? And I get a CAT scan. You've got a problem.
Well, let's just go back to what you just said a second ago, and that would be resentment from other people that have other types of debt, right? So you're talking about a slippery slope, right? The front edge of socialism.
Right.
So you forgive $50,000 in student loan debt for somebody that took it on, used that money to not go to school, you know, whatever they did. Maybe they used it for drugs. Maybe they used it to go party. Maybe they used it to buy a car. Maybe they used it to put a patio on their house. Maybe they didn't even go to school, right? And all of a sudden the government swoops in and there's this blanket, you know, oh, here's 50 grand to cover it. By the way, you know, you fucked up. It's okay. We understand you. You're the victim here. And what happens to the people like myself, right? I have a mortgage on my house that I have been dutifully paying for years and will be dutifully paying for years, trying to inch my way, you know, inch my way to progress, inch my way to equity, if you want to call it that, or somebody that's taken on $20,000 in credit card debt that's out there paying, you know, $100 or $200 more than the monthly minimum so that they could try to work away their debt. What does that person feel like when a politician decides that student loan debt has this moral high ground and that they should be forgiven, but Dave Collum, you and your mortgage, you know, you can go fuck yourself? I mean, don't you think that would lead to some civil unrest?
Well, it could. I also think that there's also people who paid off their student debts, right? So there's going to be some bad vibes there. There are some changes afoot. A number of schools are testing a model, which I'm sure I stole from someone, but about 2011 or something, I was on RT with Lauren Lister, Capital Accounts. Boy, do I miss that show. That was great. And I sort of put forth the idea that, you know, you should basically be selling tranches of student debt based on the school. So the way I put it, that, you know, if you say, you know, you the students are going to pay 10% of their income for the next 10 or 15 years, which sounds doable to me. That's a credible thing to ask of a kid, I think. And then the interest rate that they get depends on how much income they're going to get. So, you know, if you want to buy a tranche of student debt from MIT or Stanford or Caltech or Harvard, someplace like that, it would be low interest because those kids would be expected on average to produce a pretty high income. So the free market would bid the debt up to the right level.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense, because then whoever's issuing the debt, whoever takes on the liability, right? Like Purdue is doing this now.
Doing the math, right?
Right. They have to do the due diligence on the student.
Now, here's the problem, though. So what'll happen is it'll get politicized immediately. And so she brought up, like, well, what about a kid who wants to major in – aren't you going to favor kids who want to major in, you know, pre-med instead of psychology or whatever? And I said, well, actually, I wouldn't refine it that much. I would just do it by the school, because kids change majors anyways. But – and then what would happen is a school that puts out a pathetic product would go out of business.
Right.
And I'd be okay with that, too. I would be fine. The school that the kids are reading 162 minutes a semester ought to go out of business. And so the problem is the politicization would be that oh, now you're discriminating against people who are not smart enough to go to school but should get a chance to go to school, things like that. And I can imagine it getting kind of ugly. So I can imagine
that. And that politicization goes back to, you know, is college right for everybody? I mean, look, I have friends – that I went to high school with, okay, that God bless them, were not cut out for college, but they either switched in high school and went to Votech, or they learned a trade after they got out of high school. Many of whom, a couple of which, one of which I'm thinking about in particular, became an ASC mechanic, right? Was making like $120,000 or $150,000 a year just a couple years out of high school. Now owns his own tow shop. You know, I mean, so some people, college isn't the right answer, right? Like I have friends in South Philly that are welders. You know what I mean? Like college just wasn't for them, and they do very well. I have friends that I worked with at a factory up in Buffalo, New York, that are fabricators and welders and manual laborers, and you know they've made a life for themselves, and many of them are excelling at what they're doing.
Yeah, and actually, if they went to school that focused on that issue. So my older son went to a 2-year college program, an associate's degree. He was not a stellar student in high school. It was really extraordinary, actually. And he kind of grew up while in college, and he switched over to a 4-year degree. But the 2-year college he went to had 4 majors, and they were all very practical. And so I'm a big fan of that college. It's a college called Paul Smith. It's up in the Adirondacks. And they shaped young minds. They were very good at what they did. And the kids weren't – these were not academic kids, but they turned out products. They turned out kids who got jobs and things like that. Here's a counter argument to all this. So let's say you say, well, you know, there's just lousy schools that are just not putting out enough product to market, and therefore, you know, they'd go out of business because the loan system, the idea of, you know, selling tranches alone. We get a lot of our grad students from pretty small colleges. So if you look at Cornell Chemistry's PhD program, there are kids here who are from colleges that you've never heard of. And some of these kids actually end up doing very, very well. And I thought, well, maybe that's our admissions. But I one day I saw MIT's chemistry's entering class and where they were from. And I was struck by the fact that it's not just Cornell that's taking kids from a really heterogeneous-looking source. So then the question is, does a model like I just proposed, would it filter those kids out too? And so it's a tricky business. There's got to be skin in the game, to use Nassim Taleb's terminology. But I don't know. You know what you do? You apply higher standards, right? You say, look, if you're not doing X, Y, or Z, you don't get to go. Now, that was true in most colleges in the 60s, and the Vietnam War showed up. And that's when the grade inflation supposedly appeared, or so I'm told, because professors didn't want to give out any Fs because they didn't want to send a kid off to the patties, the rice patties in Vietnam. And so failures stopped appearing, Fs stopped appearing, and grade inflation soared, so the kids would not be booted and sent off to fight. So there's all sorts of ways that you know a merit-based system gets undermined. We now have, I'm told, you can withdraw from a course up to some point. You can drop a course up to some point, and if you after that point you want to withdraw, what it does is it shows up on the transcript as a withdrawal rather than being vaporized. But at least you don't get an F, right? You can withdraw right up to almost the last week of class.
I think I did that once.
Right. And I have no problem with it, except the last week is getting kind of late for a withdrawal.
Right.
So we're softening up, and I think, you know, it's kind of a snowflake thing.
I think that went in line with my strategy in college, which was do the absolute minimum possible until the very last minute, and pray to God that whatever damage that was done for the first two months of the quarter could be salvageable.
What's really fascinating is I was not a good student at all, but I got all the drugs, sex, rock and roll out of my system. Well, some of that, not all of it. In high school and in middle school, and by the time I got to college, I was terrified of flunking out and stinking, and so I actually became quite a 9 to 11, 7-day-a-week kind of student. And even then, it was a struggle because I'd done so little in high school. But so in any case, I was a success story, I guess, by that model.
I also did very little in high school. In fact, I had that aha moment, but it was graduate school. It was my undergrad. You know, I was just too busy having a good time in high school. I don't think I even would have gotten into college if it wasn't for my SATs. I mean, I just bared down that morning and said, look, here's your one shot to salvage 4 years of fucking around. And don't fuck this one up. And I lucked out and didn't, but it wasn't for that. And it really wasn't until
you need a system that, by the way, can cycle a kid back into the system if they start a little later too.
Right.
It's a very complicated problem. I don't have good answers for it. I do know that a lot of kids should not be in college.
Right. Right. All right. Well, let me move on. I have a couple of questions here that I wrote down over the last couple of days. The one that I wrote down yesterday was Christine Lagarde's comments that everybody wants to see a little more inflation. And interestingly enough, as I was perusing Twitter this morning, I noticed that you put out a comment about that. I'd like to know what your thoughts are on that. I tweeted the other day, I think this is a neurological disorder.
elitism. The banking system, the central bankers, the powers that be, various people have somehow marketed the idea that inflation is good. And you can watch them do this. It's like they hire Madison Avenue advertisers to do it. And so if you go way back, first and foremost, central bankers used to think inflation was bad. Paul Volcker is on record many, many times saying anything above zero is bad.
Way back. We're talking 4 decades, right?
Right. And you know, when he says, I hear people talk about 2% inflation rates as being tame, he says, I don't see anything tame about 2% inflation, right? So there are smart guys who understood this. But then now the central banks have gone on a marketing campaign to convince us that 2% inflation is the right number. Now, they pulled it out of their asses, right? They invented that number. There's several problems. One is they invented the number. Second problem is that that the Humphrey Hawkins legislation in 78 says that they're supposed to aim at zero. So they're breaking the law. But of course, who doesn't break the law up at that level? And then thirdly, you know, I would argue, I've been thinking about this. Now, I'm trying to understand banking. Talk about a tough goddamn problem, trying to understand banking from sitting in my office. This is not easy. But I think inflation really is when the system is levering up, and deflation is when the system is deleveraging, right?
Right.
And what part about a sort of an oscillating inflation-deflation cycle is wrong? Right, I don't get that. I can even argue that inflation, occasional inflation, is good.
Right.
I can make that as long as you have the.
As long as it's accompanied by
deflation.
Right, exactly.
Right. In fact, so here's an argument I made many, 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 many years ago to my dad in the middle of the .com bubble. As I said, one of the silver linings of this stupid thing is that from this crazy sea of nutball companies are going to emerge some really wildly successful companies, right? You know, Amazon and right, you name it, that they did come out of that ooze. And so I think that every once in a while for the system to just lose its mind and fund anything that moves will pull ideas that wouldn't have had a chance out of the woodwork, and some of those will pay off.
Right.
But you can't do that constantly, right? That's like an orgy where you say, look, we can't let the orgy stop. It's like, well, excuse me, but I'm vitamin E depleted now. You've got to stop, right? And so there's all sorts of phenomenon in this world where the breather is a critical part. So I think the central bankers claiming 2% inflation is correct. I don't think they're nuts. I think they're just liars. That's what I think.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you, do you think it's, you know, you said, look, Paul Volcker was the last person to understand it. Do you think people really don't understand it? Do you think central banks don't understand it? Or do you think they're just full of shit? You think they're just lying? Because honestly, to me, Dave, the most likely scenario, Bill Fleckenstein disagrees with me when we talk with Fleckenstein, will say they just don't know. They're just fucking dumb. And I always say, I don't know. I think you're right about this marketing campaign idea, because I don't know if you remember the Paul Krugman versus Ron Paul debate from like 2013 or whatever on the air. But at one point, when the newswoman was questioning them and she was talking about inflation, she says, you know, to Ron Paul, Dr. Paul, you know, what's wrong with inflation? Don't we need a little inflation to, you know, get things going? You know, it's like, the fuck are you talking about? You know, like, so I think that that advertising campaign that you talked about has worked. The question is, are they knowingly presenting this fool's errand, right? This moral hazard to benefit the politicians and to keep kind of all hell from breaking loose for benefit really of the people, the higher ups and the politicians, because it silences their constituency. People aren't up in arms. Are they kind of sacrificing the long term for the short term knowingly? Or is this just, we got a bunch of idiots that are failing to understand these basic economic policies, these basic economic principles?
You know, there's a question that the guys I chat with, we've probably been asking it to each other off and on since the late 90s. And the question is, you know, when Greenspan was doing what he was doing, is he oblivious or is he lying? I really am inclined to believe he's lying. I'm also inclined to believe that they know stuff that I don't know, right? And you say, well, of course, that's true. And I go, yeah,
sure.
Maybe. But and they're afraid of deflation, but I, if I had to guess, I would say that they can see the problems you and I see, and it scares the hell out of them. And so they're attempting to somehow get through it. They're attempting to find some way to muddle their way through, to use a Malden term, and get to the other side and have the so-called soft landing. I'm guessing Powell sees, you know, I would think he loses sleep. And if he doesn't, then I think he's a boob. And so then the question is, where's this 2% inflation thing come from? Well, first and foremost, the system is inherently inflationary. So if there's all the money in the world and it's socked away in interest-bearing accounts, by definition, there has to be more money next year than this year, because let's say on average these interest-bearing accounts pay 3%. Then if you have $100 trillion in the system this year, you got to have $100.03 trillion next year. And so where's that money come from? Well, that's got to be a sort of a money creation phenomenon. And if you don't create the money, say, well, what happens if you don't create the money? Well, then there's got to be defaults. Right. So if I borrow 3%, right, and I pay you 3%, or the bank pays you 3%, then to have a non-inflationary system requires somewhere out there, since not everyone can make 3%, there's got to be defaults.
Right. It's a zero sum game.
That's the deflationary restoring force. And so you can sort of maybe run a little hot for a while, but then there's got to be defaults because the money doesn't exist.
Right.
And so the question is the system with defaults any better than the system with an inherent inflation rate? And I personally would like to try it for once. I think, you know, it's been a long time. You know, they worry about deflation. When was the last time we had deflation? Well, 1930s, right? And they didn't like that. But at the same time, the reason they didn't like it is because the Federal Reserve screwed up in the 20s. And that's undeniable, too. So when Bernanke talks about mistakes made in the 30s, he's got to be lying. He has got to be lying, because it is well documented that the 20s was a huge credit bubble. The Fed lowered its reserve requirement three times in the 20s. They lowered interest rates throughout the 20s. They did all the things that we know create massive bubbles. And then we got the bubble burst. And then the Fed, of course, always says the reason we got the depression was because we screwed up in the 30s. We didn't print enough money. I would say we got the depression. I could show you a plot that convinces me of this, too. We got the depression because we had a huge credit-based bubble. We had pulled demand forward, and now it was time to sober up. And we had to suck it up, and we had a lot of defaults. And I think you could have a more humane system where – you don't have to have bank failures, but there's got to be some way for failures to fail, right? There's got to be some way, and so. But
there has to be that blow off valve, right? to
There's got to be a way to erase mistakes, right?
I mean, think
of it in terms of pregnancies, right? How many pregnancies end in miscarriage, right? Well, the reason you have miscarriages is because something failed, right? It's not a disaster. It's Mother Nature saying that one didn't work. You better do that one again.
Right.
Same idea.
And you know, like I was saying, I worked at a factory up in Buffalo some years back, and we had a big proprietary chemical process that worked up there in this big giant, you know, couple of 20-ton reactors, and it wasn't even a pressurized process, but every once in a while something would get stuck. Something would get stuck in one of the augers, or something would get stuck in one of the transfer pipes. And eventually, if we didn't have a blow-off valve, you know, which kicked at a certain PSI and let the shit out the stack instead of, you know, blowing up the machine, it would have blew up and killed everybody. And this is...
Yeah, so it's like a projectile vomit that's been cut off at the pass with a cork in your mouth, right? Tell me how that works out. You know, this gets back to Taleb's idea of anti-fragile. I'm kind of a Taleb fan. He's a tough guy, that's for sure, but he does have interesting ideas. And you know, he points out all these things to try to make the system more safe or more stable, just make it more fragile. And he even makes, you know, when you sprain your ankle and you ice the wound to get the swelling down, he says, why? Mother Nature needs swelling.
Right.
Mother Nature did it, right? Why would you cut the swelling? If I get intestinal distress, I don't take Imodium right away. Who wants to cut off that at the pass, right? My body's saying, blow that out. Whatever it is you ate last night, it is time to get it out of there. And so I let it rip. But I do think whoever invented Imodium should be given a Nobel Prize. That's a separate issue.
All right. Central bankers are out. Imodium is in. You heard it here first on this podcast. How about this guy today on CNBC? I don't even want to try and pronounce his name. Shamath Palihapitiya, venture capitalist. He got in early on Facebook and the Golden State Warriors. And he says today, central banks have almost eliminated recessions. And to me, this is a derivative of what we're just talking about, right? We're talking about central bankers and politicians selling to the public this idea that inflation's good, selling to the public that monetary policy as it exists today is good. And from that kind of toxic sale, we get these toxic derivatives, which is this statement that central banks have almost eliminated recessions versus what's actually happening, which is they're covering up recessions. Recessions are still happening. You know, they haven't eliminated them. And so as we kind of continue down this road, does it frighten you that we're moving exponentially, as Elon Musk would say, orders of magnitude in the wrong direction here? At some point, does this accelerate and blow off at some point soon?
Well, you know, so I was listening to a Lacey Hunt interview with Macro Voices. Both are very good to listen to. He pointed out how bad the economy is. He points out some very counterintuitive things, which I really have to think hard about whether I endorse, but he's so smart that I'm reluctant. I'm very reluctant to ignore him. He says that, you know, when central bankers when interest rates are dropping, the economy's stinking, right? When interest rates get really low, it's because the economy just sucks, right? And people have talked about that. But he says that essentially what we're seeing is we're seeing the destructive process that you and I are saying must occur in terms of just a really trashy economy. And it just stinks. And he says it's growing at about 1.6% per capita, which is a great, great great distinction, because per capita accounts for demographics, which a lot of people forget about. And he says we're rotting the system, and he talks about how the increased debt is rotting the system. And so instead of seeing the big fireworks, we're seeing just a decaying corpse, and so it doesn't have to blow up, it can just turn into a puddle of ooze too. And that's what he sees.
Well, there you go, then at least we have something to look forward to.
Well, I hate the model because I want a big blow up so that I can go buy, you know, real estate in Dresden in 1946, right? That's what I'm looking to do. I want to buy, you know, open acreage in the middle of London. So I'm positioned both for inflation and deflation, which means I'm going to get hurt no matter what. But I'm kind of hoping that one side of the barbell will save me.
How do you position for inflation and deflation?
Hard assets and cash.
There you go.
Right.
I have a couple.
They're not likely to work simultaneously, right?
Right. Well, if you hit one hard enough in one direction, it shouldn't matter, right?
Right. So if we get a serious sell-off, I just saw. Oh, by the way, we should. Your viewers know this. Again, I always hate to tell a smart group stuff that I'm sure they already know, but the semiconductor industry is going down the tubes fast. Intel got the crap kicked out of it last week. Samsung got the crap kicked out of it this week. These are big, serious misses. And this has been getting documented, guys like Fred Hickey, for quite some time now, but now it seems to be coming true. And someone posted a plot today. It was phenomenal, where you can see the semiconductor sort of overvaluations of their stocks plotted against the S&P, and the overvaluations of the semiconductors are top calling things, and they're starting to tank now. And you know, as the chips go down, you know, when the chips fall, it's telling you the economy is falling, and I can't tell you what that explicit connectivity is, but I'm going to say okay, we'll call it an indicator, and they're falling, they're getting crushed, and they've got growing inventories, they're getting reduced revenues, and so that should scare the hell out of the markets, and the markets couldn't give a damn. So that you know, they won't care until they do, and then it'll just be all holy hell breaking loose, presumably. And I'm kind of hoping to buy the S&P somewhere below
300,
1200.
Oh, I would love it. I would love it. Oh, they would just. I wouldn't even need to buy anything. I wouldn't even need to make the money, because to just watch it occur would be enough for me.
The risk is, and this is what scares me, the risk is that everyone thinks that every sell-off is a V-bounce. And,
right.
You know, just ask the Japanese, right? They didn't get a V-bounce. They got 25 years of crap. And you know, if you own the Nikkei in 1989, you say, yeah, but I'm patient. Yeah, you're down 50%. What is it, 30 years later, 26 years later, something
right.
like that. And you can't burn 26 years and lose half your money. No one can afford that.
Yeah.
So if we get one of those.
And we will.
Well, I thought we did in 2009 and then they retrieved it. And so if we get one of those protracted sells, maybe with inflation gurgling too high, we're going to get gutted.
I mean, don't you just think it's inevitable, though?
Oh, I've given up thinking anything's inevitable. I think we're going to get our ass kicked. I don't know how. How we get it kicked is not inevitable, right? There's a lot of ways to skin a cat, right? There's we can end up with a stagflation. We can end up with a high inflation. We can end up with a deflation. I'm a bigger deflationist than I ever used to be. I believe these guys when they said that a central bank can create inflation. I am not totally convinced of that now.
So I want to go back to one thing that you said earlier. We were talking about the Fed targeting 2% inflation and how that's against the law. You said they're breaking the law, which jogged my memory to one of my fond discussions that I had about why I believe that the Federal Reserve is, and if they are not right now, they are probably very close to and will be interfering in the futures markets and buying index futures or just buying equities. Something, again, that Bill Fleckenstein vehemently disagrees with me on. But one of the arguments that I got against that I always took exception with was it's against the law. And I was like, I don't think they fucking care about that. I'm not saying it's happening right now, but the argument that it's against the law is not going to be the thing that stops them if they decide.
But I think what Bill's pushing against is the idea that they're doing it now, and I'm not sure there's any evidence of that. I think that's Grumpy Bear saying that. They're certainly trying to juice the markets, but they're trying to juice it, I think, probably through reasonably legal channels. by juicing it with monetary policy. But they will change the law, and there'll be a rebranding. They'll say, you know, it'll be really in our best interest if the Fed could buy equities, that would help the economy. And we'll start hearing that crap. And I'll be squealing like a pig on Twitter when we start getting those trial balloons going up. So Bill, I think, is right now, and he might change his tune later. There's a couple of things that I think there's degrees of market manipulation that he's willing to sign off on and degrees he's not. So I think he's right when he says they're not jerking the gold market on a daily basis. But at the same time, I think they do care about the price of gold. I think if you want to generate inflation like gold soar, that'll give people the perception of inflation. So
I think, well, look, I'll agree with you and I'll agree with Bill. And I think I have that it's probably not happening now. But to me, you know, watching the way that everything here, and I'm still learning, right? I'm very much a neophyte when it comes to this stuff. But watching how easily how malleable the central bankers are, and then just watching something like how they've interfered in the bond market, which they have been public about. As Fleckenstein always says, if they get in the equity market, they'll fucking brag about it like the Japanese do, right? And I think he might be right there. But to me, it's always very easy for me to draw a straight line, and you put the bond market and the equity market next to each other, one on each hand, and they're both very similar, right? And you say, look, here's one that the central banks have manipulated beyond belief, and here's this other one that they haven't touched. I mean, to me, it just seems like the obvious next thing that'll happen, right? As long as we continue along this train of thought that we're on now.
Well, Yellen's already talked about it, right?
A couple of weeks
or a couple of months ago. I don't know, it gets blurry. She talked about how it might be to the advantage of the Federal Reserve to buy other kinds of assets, and that's a trial balloon. And maybe she's just babbling incoherently as a ex-Fed governor. But my guess is that there's method to her madness. Probably more madness than method, but there's some. And so you're right. I think law won't stop them from doing something if they think it'll help. And, you know, the Japanese buying up equities and ETFs, that seems just insane to me. And I don't care if they think it'll help. I don't think you want to be nationalizing your economy that way. I think it's just bad karma.
It's just nuts.
They deserve the malaise they're in. They deserve it.
And it's like taxation. I mean, you can only go so far, right? You can only tax somebody 100%, right? Or if you want to go back to the Laffer curve, right? There's a certain point where you start to tax people and they just say, well, fuck it, I'm not doing anything else anymore. You know, so you remove the incentive. And I think about it similarly with buying equities, in the sense that there's only so, you know, you can only own so much of so many companies before eventually, you know, then what? You got no bidders and no offers, and when the thing's fucked, it's fucked. And I mean, what happens at that point?
When the government owns it's no longer functional, right? The entire Japanese bond market's a goner, right? It's DOA. It is so bad, right? This is a sovereign bond market where there are days where a bond doesn't trade, right? That's a completely and utterly broken bond market. Now, you can say, but Japan's not starving. They're not going down the toilet. Well, they are in the middle of almost three-decade malaise, so there's something dead wrong there. But the problem is, what happens when they need a bond market?
Right.
Right? They don't have one right now. There's no bond market. And so somehow there is this sense I have is that free markets have ways of wiggling free, and they will find a way to thwart the efforts of those who think they can be manipulated.
Well, I think it's an inevitability, right?
I think so. Yeah, inevitability. Exactly. But the mechanics are not an inevitability, right? So we all thought that, you know, inflation was guaranteed to show up when they started doing their whole QE thing, and it never really showed up. I mean, there's always inflation. I got an argument with some guy today who's saying that the dollar's stronger than it was 20 years ago. I go, you're an idiot. The dollar's not stronger than 20 years ago. What's your benchmark? Oh, other currencies. Well, you're an idiot. Then,
right.
You know, it's in a land of midgets. And so I went and showed him how much the dollar had depreciated using the CPI, which is at best an optimistic estimate of how much the dollar had depreciated. And no one cares about what is depreciation relative to the euro or the yen or whatever. I care about depreciation against the cost of my heating bill.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And that's something that people, they just, that's one of those big kind of basic principles that people just miss. And I'm not talking about, you know, I'm just talking about your everyday mom and pop. You know, they just, it's something, it happens so, it happens in such tiny increments, you know, that people just don't notice. You know, you don't, 2% is a nice number because you don't notice 2% a year. You know, you just know, oh, prices just tick up a little bit.
Here's a bone I have to pick. If you actually look at, everyone thinks somehow the equity markets are going to save us. You know, forget about valuation. We're so toast on the valuation. We're 2x overvalued. So they can't save us. We've pulled appreciation forward. That's what a bubble is. Pulling huge appreciation forward, that's a bubble. I want to buy deferred appreciation. And here's the key is if you actually look at the historical gains on the equity markets over a long period of time, and you get some number, which is often cited, and then you start subtracting away critical things, which no one likes to subtract. Like if you start subtracting away fees, and you start subtracting away inflation, and you subtract away taxes, not just taxes on the real gains, but in taxes on the inflated gains. So if the market doubles due to just inflation, you get taxed on that even though you didn't make a penny.
Right.
And so if you wonder why governments like inflation, it's because they get to tax the inflation. And so then the reason I mentioned Lacey Hunt's per capita, because over the 20th century the population quadrupled. And so you say, well, what's that have to do with the price of rhubarb? Well, it turns out that if the number of people eating the pie is up fourfold, you shouldn't just be measuring how much the pie grew. You should be measuring the per capita growth of the pie. And that turns out to be something like, I can't remember, it's 0.4% or 0.6% per year that really ought to be dealt with. And so you do all of this. I came up with a long-term valuation independent equity return of 4 to 4.5%. That's where I got to, you know, assuming the average dividends over the period, you name it. But I've seen people come in as low as 3.5%. So if you think the average person investing out there realizes that they're going to get, let's say, 4%, that's just not the case. The average person somehow thinks if they're buy and hold, they're 8 or 9 percenters. And that's just wrong. That's just not correct. It's not even close. Now, if you throw in the 2x overvalued, how long does it take for 4% growth to undo the 2x overvalued? And the answer is about 20 years.
Right.
Right? Using the 72 rule gets you to about, I don't know, 17 years, something like that. So we got to grow 4%. We got to grow a normal GDP or got to return 4% a year on what should be the growth and give it all back just to get back to fair value. And where the boomers, they're all going to be drooling in their drool cups in the nursing homes by then, right? So I really pray that we get a correction that undoes this fast, because I don't want to be waiting around, you know, with my dead cold fingers on the mouse waiting to click a buy order.
Right? So you can prove that you were right, you know.
Yeah,
seven seconds
right,
before you
right.
die,
you
right?
Wait.
Exactly. Yep. All right, Mr. Column. You know.
I also want to see guys like Mark Dow eat it.
Well, that goes back to what
Mark,
I was just saying.
Mark, if you hear this, sorry, dude, you go after me too many times.
It's just what I was saying before. I was like, you know, it almost, you know, you said, oh, I want to buy a plot of land in London, and I was just thinking, man, like I would just like to see the look on Scott Nation's face, you know, like. That would make it worth it. You know, that's my currency. You know, that's
so my troll count is so high now that I think we're getting close.
My currency.
The number of people who just like to throw bait at me and just say you're a tool, dead wrong. The number of guys picking on the Bears is just so high now that I think we're getting pretty close.
When I can see Steve Leisman have like some type of intestinal movement on the air, you know, you just see his face. Shift.
Yeah, but those are not the important guys. The important guys are the ones who are moving a lot of money who are rabid, right?
I know, but
the ones who somehow think is, oh yeah, I'm going to time it, right? Now we're all market timers. If I'm sitting in cash, I timed.
Right.
Right.
That's true.
I'm, and And the Fed has made me look pretty goddamn stupid for the last decade. So I am betting that they are incompetent. That's my bet.
Oh, they most certainly are. And what I say on the podcast all the time is, it might not be this week, next week, this month, this year, next year, 10 years. I don't know how long they can kick the can down the road. I'm sure somebody with a protractor and a ruler and some graph paper could chart something out for me, some type of expensive calculator.
It's too chaotic.
I'm not fucking interested.
That's the problem.
Well, there's too many variables, right? There's too many.
Well, yeah, the system is literally chaotic. I think literally using the physics term of chaos, right? It's not predictable. And so you say, well, then you should just buy and hold. Well, but what is predictable is overvaluation. I personally find that at current valuations, the forward return is so bleak,
right,
that I'm willing to forfeit it.
Right.
Now, in 2009, I had started buying, but I was convinced we had a long ways to go because I didn't realize the Fed would dump tens of trillions and the central banks would. So that's the part I missed completely. And I don't know a single person who saw it. I have asked so many people, do you have any articles by anyone who would put some serious, like, multi-trillion-dollar numbers on Fed intervention?
Right.
When this thing busts, and no one has provided me anything besides, you know, articles where the guy says they'll do whatever it takes, right? I don't care about that. That's not a prediction. That's that's like Nostradamus predicting bad things will happen 3 centuries from now.
that's my gig. Don't diss that.
So I at the bottom in 2009 was not buying out of greed, right? So most people say, you sell at the bottom out of fear. I was not buying out of greed. I wish I'd gotten really aggressive, but I thought we had a long ways to go. I think I will attenuate that next time. So I'm going to be doing the math and saying, okay, at the current levels, I will get X percent return going forward on average based on historical numbers. I'll risk this much money to do that. And I remember there's a Doug Cleggett quote from, I think it was pre-99, where he was talking about the S&P, and you know how far back it is because the numbers I quote. He says, you know, when the S&P 700, I'll be bullish. This is when it was above that. And then he says, when the S&P is 500, I'll be really bullish. When it's 300, I'll wish I'd saved my ammo. And that was sort of my thinking.
Right.
Don't the guys who bought in 31 still got their butts handed to them. The guys who bought the Nikkei from 89 through whatever the present. I'm going to do the math on the Nikkei. I don't think – if you average your way through this bust, the Nikkei bust, you're even maybe. I don't even think you are. I'm going to get someone to do a spreadsheet. Anyone out there can do a spreadsheet on the Nikkei, send me an email. I want to know what you would have made if you were a young punk 22-year-old young executive and you put $2,000 a month every month into the Nikkei starting in 89. What happened? And I don't think it's much because we're sitting at a level that's about the average of those years. So the average buy-in would have been about that number. So I think you still would have gotten your ass kicked.
Yeah, I want to go now to just a couple of questions that some of my listeners submitted from the last time that you were on. The first one I already covered, which was about student debt. So that was actually one I wanted to talk to you about on the last podcast. You want an economic question or you want a chemistry question? That's my
anything you want.
I'll give you a chemistry question. My buddy Jack says, what the fuck does he do in chemistry? I know I could just watch one of his interviews, but it's been a while.
Now, this is actually a better question than Jack realized.
But it's been it's been a while since I took Orgo. And what got lost in the jargon, he talked a lot about his experiences pre.com, but could you ask him about his experiences in 2008, which I think he covered. But what do you do in chemistry?
Well, let me back it up. There's kind of a funny story. So I was a lousy student in high school, and you say, well, how'd you get into Cornell? Well, turns out, and this is legacy. People say, I have a friend who's going to get my son in, blah, 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 blah. When I applied to Cornell, I didn't know this, but my grandfather was vice president of the Board of Regents of New York State and president of the National Alumni Association. So he controlled every penny into the Cornell Ag School. So shock of shocks, I got in. In this era, that would be a scandal, but it wasn't, and I earned my keep. So in any event, so I was a genetics major, and I decided I wanted to study organic chemistry. So I took a bunch of grad courses. I took one semester non-major organic course loved it. So I took a bunch of grad courses, and that was a gigantic quantum leap into the abyss. And I survived somehow, and I ended up going off to Columbia to do organic chemistry. I decided at the very last minute. And but I was my training was on stilts, right? 4 grad courses in organic and nothing else. And so I almost flunked out of Columbia, best I could tell. The courses were hard, put it that way. And then I got lucky in grad school, and my PhD research went stupendously, as in if you made me do it 100 times again, I wouldn't be able to replicate it. And so I found myself interviewing for jobs at the end of my second year of grad school. So I got my PhD in about 2.5 to 3/4 years, skipped the postdoc, and went straight back to Cornell, right? What an amazing thing. That's like U.S. beating Russians in hockey.
Right.
And I knew I was profoundly overrated. So I was trained to do what's called synthetic organic chemistry, trained for all of about, 14 months, to do synthetic organic chemistry. That's where you make complex organic molecules of the type that the drug companies sell, things like that. And then I, while I was interviewing for jobs, decided I was going to switch fields again because, why stick around for more than 14 months? So I went into what's called physical organic organometallic chemistry, and I didn't know anything. I mean nothing. Nothing, absolutely zero. And I got to Cornell, and I raised some money from the feds doing synthetic chemistry. But as soon as I got the money, I switched over to physical organic about halfway through my assistant professorship. That was reckless as hell. The physical organic chemistry was a dead field. And I was assured that I was doing something crazy. I had people say, you'll never get funded. You'll never survive. The field's dead. No one cares. And what I saw, right, this is going to make so much fucking sense. I saw a bottom. I saw a field that had been dormant and that there were a whole bunch of new questions to be answered, a whole bunch of new issues to be addressed that had gone dormant because everyone who had been in the field was buried in a shallow grave somewhere. And so I switched, and I almost died, right? I had to get tenure. That was no small feat in a new field. And then I almost ran out of money. I had trouble convincing the feds. But then I went on quite a rage, and I put up, for the chemists who are listening, I put up 21 grants in a row funded. That's a 1 in 10 to the 13th based on funding ratios. And I got to the present. And what I study is organometallic chemistry with a specialty in lithium and sodium now. It turns out they say lithium, really? Organolithium chemistry? It turns out lithium is the – oh, there'll be some people shit their pants on this. Lithium is the most important metal, bar none, to organic chemistry. Now, the palladium team will say, oh, no, palladium's more important. No, it's not. I'll debate you on in another forum, but it's not. And any event, lithium chemistry is exceedingly complicated. You get all these crazy structures and solutions. You got to figure out what they are, and then you got to figure out how they work and what the chemistry is. And so that's what I study. And so, this is the complexity that I like. And so what I didn't see coming, this was the contrarian play that I got lucky on, was two things. One is that when I first started, pharma companies were not willing to use fancy reagents. Not willing to use fancy chemistry. They perceived the costs were too high and stuff like that. And then somewhere along the way, the pharma guys realized, holy shit, wait a minute. For every, they need a kilogram of something to test, to do the first phase of clinical trials. So they don't jam it into soccer moms, but that's the joke. And they test it to find out if the drug really does cause your testicles to descend or causes your, causes your period to lengthen. I don't know. But what happens is they about 9 out of 10 of those drugs die. And the pharma guys said, holy shit, we got to find a way to get these a kilogram of each of these things faster. And what happened is it changed their attitude. And I don't know why it happened, but it changed their attitude. And they went from going, we don't use that kind of chemistry, to just get me the damn kilo. And that's why they outsourced to China and India, because they're saying to China and India, just get me the damn kilo. And so what it did is it brought a whole bunch of wild chemistry into pharma. And that dragged me in. And I didn't see that coming. The second thing that happened is we monitor how reactions proceed. We monitor reaction rates and things like that. And that was way out of favor. That's, it's called kinetics. It's how rates change with concentrations and things like that, and what makes chemistry work and not work. And it turns out it was way out of favor, and then along comes Intel. And Intel puts out microchips, puts out laptops. Every vessel inside pharma has a computer hooked to it now. And what that computer does, it gives various measurements as a function of time, and that's kinetics. And all of a sudden, the pharma guys are going, oh, boy, we've got this data, this time-dependent data coming in, and what do we do with it? And someone said, someone must know how to do this. And then they look and they go, oh, there's that column guy. So next thing I knew, I was you know, I'd gone to a lot of pharmas, but all of a sudden, there's a big demand. And so they use the fancy stuff we do. They use the kinetics we do. And so I spend more time inside pharma than I do inside academics in some ways. And so that's, and if you think about it, it's all contrarian stuff. It's complexity. In some sense, you can see why I find markets interesting.
Sure, yeah. Tell somebody that doesn't know.
That was a long answer for you, but
no.
I've never given that.
Tell somebody that doesn't understand organic chemistry or metals what's so fascinating to you about lithium.
So what happens is the carbon-lithium bond is wildly reactive.
Okay, nobody has any clue what that means.
So what happens is if we expose one of these compounds to the air, it's like napalm, but without the delay.
Okay.
Just lights right up from the air.
Okay.
And so we have to work inside containment vessels and things like that. We have to make sure. Now, these reagents, you can buy them in a bottle from chemical companies, but don't drop the bottle at your feet or you'll be standing in an inferno. And in fact, that has happened to people, right? So they're wildly reactive, and what they are useful for is forming bonds, right? So if you want to form a bond that's hard to form, you want a wild stallion of a reagent to form it, and that's what the lithium compounds are. They're very, very reactive, so it's very high potential energy, way up there on the curve, and so you know, you don't want a dead reagent. Those things don't react with anything. And so the lithium and sodium's even more so. But sodium got ignored since 4.5 billion years now. And there's a couple of really stupidly simple technical reasons why sodium got ignored, in my opinion. And we figured out that that was what was inhibiting the world's consumption of these. And we figured out how to beat it. And so we've been publishing for just a couple of years now organosodium reagents, which are even more reactive. And I think people just fucked up by not knowing how to do it right. That was the bet. And so far, it seems to be working pretty well. If there's chemists out there listening, we've got some really, really, really cool stuff coming that lithium can't do and sodium does. So the pharma guys are using these. They use these things on 5,000-gallon scales. And they're not afraid to use these things now. They used to be. And so when the real big break one day is Merck called and said, we've got this process. We don't understand it at all. And they described it. And I said, look, that's going to be a mess, right? But send me the samples. I'll take a peek. And I thought we were going to say, look, this is hopelessly complex. The whole thing unfolded beautifully. And we got really great press. And the whole Merck, you know, establishment went bonkers over this stuff, and so then I started getting calls from pharma saying, would you look at this, would you look at this, would you look at this? And so we had a sort of a unique skill set, but the lithium based reagents are, you know, ragingly reactive towards other compounds.
Got it. Okay, so why lithium over palladium? Why would the palladium guys argue the other side of the story?
Oh, it turns out that they do different kinds of chemistry, and the palladium guys, we all think we're centers of the universe, but I had a friend who actually went through 500 organic syntheses. Those are the big complex molecules that everyone likes to make, and he made a spreadsheet of what reagents people use. And Pfizer did the same thing within their process group. They said, what reagents do we use when we scale up? What are the important reactions? So they decided to do that by looking at 20 years of their history. And it turns out the lithium-based reagents dominate on both surveys.
Very interesting. That's I mean, do you take some of that expertise and do you apply it at all when, I mean, obviously you invest in precious metals. So you have a bit of a fundamental understanding to this stuff that probably the average investor, even like somebody who supports buying precious metals, doesn't really understand. Is there anything from your chemistry background that kind of figures into that? I mean, are you long other metals aside from gold and silver or no?
Well, I should be long lithium in theory. I'm long silver because of the silver applications and technology. Every single electrical device in the world has silver in it. And so and it's not recyclable. And so to the extent that what influences silver is that it's often isolated as a side product to other kinds of mining, copper, zinc, whatever. And so if the economy's rolling along, there's tons of silver coming off as a side product. And so I would make the argument that when the economy goes to crap, silver ought to go up because you need silver, but they're not mass producing the other stuff. Maybe I'm still thinking about it. I've owned silver since it was about $370 an ounce. So even though silver beat me up recently, I'm still up, I don't know, fourfold, something like that. And I don't make much out of, you know, when Merck had a real disastrous blow up with Vioxx, and Vioxx had a yank from the market. It was one of these mega drugs. And I said to a friend who was at J.P. Morgan at the time, but he had been at Merck, but he was this big swinging dick at J.P. Morgan, and he'd done all sorts of venture capital. I said, Al, should I be buying Merck stock at this point? He said, no, they could be fourfold bankrupt. And that was just not true. Merck survived fine, and I should have bought Merck. And I don't have any great wisdom about what's going on inside pharma, besides the fact that it just looks like a very expensive place to a very expensive business to run, and it's a great political risk right now. And if you look at pharma's 40-year performance, most of it's in the 80s and 90s. So there's this real ramp up, and then it sort of really tanked, and most of the return came for Pfizer, Merck, and companies like that in the 80s and 90s.
So to go from the tangible to the intangible, have you ever looked at Bitcoin? Do you have thoughts on the cryptocurrency? Another one of my listeners wanted me to ask you.
I have no interest in Bitcoin. I'm sympathetic to the Bitcoin crowd because of the disdain for central bankers.
Right.
as I tell people, I tell my class, every major decision I ever make, including investment decisions, life decisions, every single one I send through one critical filter. And that filter is, if this turns out horribly wrong, will I forgive myself? Well, I look back and say, look, that's the best I had. So as I look back at 2009 and say, you know, I decided not to buy aggressively in 2009. And I look back, I go, do I forgive myself? I wish I had, but I wish I was 25 years old again. But I don't look back and say that was bad thinking. My process was fine. And if you get the process right, you're supposed to get overall the outcome right. And I'm still hoping that's true. So I look at Bitcoin and I don't understand it. I have one serious concern about Bitcoin that I couldn't get myself past no matter what, and that is I believe that if Bitcoin threatens sovereign currencies, and the Bitcoin guys all think this is going to happen, I think, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, at least that's
right?
Part
their
of
their bet is that Bitcoin's going to take over the world.
Well, their bet is that it's going to get too big to regulate, you know, and ostensibly it's going to get past this event horizon where once it gets big enough, people won't be able to regulate it.
Right. So here are several problems. One is, for a while they were enthusiastic about it because it was just untouchable. And then there've been all these stories and thievery and robberies and hacking
right.
and stuff. And so to the extent that I'm nervous about having gold in a safe deposit box, I'd be nervous having Bitcoin in some ethereal, you know, wallet or whatever they're called. That would trouble me. The second thing is, you know, again, I was asked about Bitcoin back probably 2011. I wish I'd shut my mouth then and just bought some too. But I don't regret not doing it from the filtering mechanism, from the do you regret in
right.
a fundamental way. Do you forgive yourself for not buying it? Absolutely. The thing that I think is absolutely the drop-dead problem that Bitcoin has not convinced me otherwise is that I think if sovereign states are threatened, They have monopolies on currency production. Now, the euro is different than the dollar, but they all agree that they don't want to have to compete with other stuff.
Right.
And they're not making much noise now. They even talk, they wax philosophically about how they're talking about having their own cryptocurrency. It's like, excuse me, you already do, right? You're already fabricating the shit with pixels. And so the question then is, when the sovereigns actually get threatened, what are they going to do? And the answer is, they're going to outlaw it.
Of course.
And they're going to, the heavy hand of the state, capital S state, is going to come down on the heads of anyone they can get their hands on. And how are they going to do it? Well, first of all, and it's already happening, every time you spend a Bitcoin, either will or already, I'm not sure which, it'll be a taxable event because it'll be an appreciation. Now, if my dollar appreciates for some crazy reason that's unprecedented, they're not going to tax it yet, at least. And when it depreciates, they don't get anything, but they get the depreciation out of it. But if they make every Bitcoin transaction taxable, meaning you have to keep a ledger, then you're up your ass in complexity. And then the second thing they'll do is outlaw. Now, you can say, oh, yeah, that's the beauty of Bitcoin because it's off radar, blah, blah, blah. You think Joe Sixpack's going to want to defy the state and use Bitcoin?
It's not only that. The one thing I could never get pass with Bitcoin, and admittedly I own very, very, very little just for speculative purposes, but the one thing I could never get past, which is a very basic, you know, fifth grade, fourth grade type problem, is if the grid goes down, what the fuck are you holding? You know what I mean? Forget about the state intervening. I mean, I think it would be easier for the state to intervene due to the fact that it's digital, but like, what happens if the power goes out? I mean, how about that for a question?
Then we end up in a road warrior situation if it goes out for a long time. And if it's for a short time, then you get it back. So that doesn't scare me as much. But I've been talking to my students about backing up our hard drives, for Christ's sakes. I'm worried about you losing my Word files.
Right.
So the idea of worrying about Bitcoin scares me even more. But I think if you make Bitcoin illegal, if you make the cryptocurrencies illegal, which they will if they have to. That part I don't doubt. Then we're going to find out if the cryptos are bigger than the sovereign states.
That would be the point, right?
And I don't think they are. I don't think people will use it as a currency comfortably if it's illegal.
Are you, Dave? Are you short any individual stocks, or are you just basically betting against the system with your cash and your precious metals?
I don't trade anything anymore at all. I don't do anything really speculative anymore. I'm really looking for meat and potatoes. So I tried to short something 3 times. And the first time was from 99 to 02, and I think I got about a 30% gain. That was using the Prudent Bear Fund. And even with fees and stuff, I made about 30%. And then I neutralized a college fund in that had energy in it. I'm a little vague on this one, must have been around like 05 to 09. And when I started buying, the first thing I did is liquidate the bear market fund. And so I made about 30% again. What I do remember is I sold the bear market fund in 7 aliquots, in which the average Dow was at 6,700. And so that was just goddamn lucky. I had friends saying, why are you getting out now? There's much more downside. And I said, look, I'm going to sit in the cabana and drink watching you guys surf. I've had enough on this particular venture. So that worked brilliantly, and it was just dumb luck. The third thing I did is I tried to short bonds with a RIDEX fund. Forget about the erosional costs, where they're just sitting there salivating, waiting for someone as stupid as me to step into their lair so they can eat me. Because it didn't track. The tracking error was just massive. And I got so – I called the guy. I said, why is your fund doing so badly? The guy just kept giving me evasive answers. I finally dumped that. But I had called 2 people to chat about shorting the bond fund. One was Mark Gilbert of Bloomberg, who's their bond guy. And he said, don't do it. And then the other was Gerard Minnick via a couple emails. And he said, don't do it. And I ignored him. And then after I was done, I said, screw it, I'm out. And that was the last time. So I think shorting is for incredibly dexterous people. People who short markets or stocks because they're overvalued are going to die. you really, so Fleckenstein's got this, you know, shoot him in the back mentality. You know, guys like Druckenmiller apparently seems to know how to really recognize when the tide is turned and then shoot him in the back the whole
and
way.
That's what Fleck, so, that's what Fleck does. He always says, you know, what he always says to me
shoot
is
him in the back.
Exactly. He'll get short, and as it starts to go down, you know, that's when he presses, when he thinks he's got them on the run, right?
And I don't have the skill to spot that beyond just wait for Bill to tell me to do it. and that just, you know, one time I had a friend at Goldman who founded their tech stock, who founded their software group back in the early 80s. What an amazing ground zero moment. He founded their software group. He took Microsoft public. He took all Oracle, all these things public. His name is Rick Sherlin. And one day I called him, and he wasn't there, and I left his secretary. I said if Rick gets a stock that he'd recommend to his grandmother, make sure you give me a call, right?
Right.
And so about a half hour later, she calls me back, and she said he went to the office, and he said Rational Software. I go, this is like Blue Anaconda, whatever that thing is in Wall Street. And he said, Rational Software. And I said, really? Rational Software? So I look it up, the thing had gone straight down. This is in the tech bubble. It had gone straight down. And I'm looking at thinking, yeah, but a guy I've known for 30 years and who's the number one software guy in the world just told me to buy it. So I'm waiting, thinking, okay, it's going to bottom, then I'll buy it, right? I'll try to pick it off at the bottom. I don't know what Rational Software does. It's object-oriented software, whatever. And I'm about to buy it, and they announce earnings, and they tank another 10%. I go, what is that? So I call him back, and she says, let me put Rick on the phone. So he gets on the phone, and he tells me, he says, I'm going to have a conference call with 125 of my clients on Tuesday, and I think they're going to tell a good story. And so on Monday, I went in to an account, and I bought a ton of Rational Software, a ton for me at the time. I didn't have much money at the time. And then on Tuesday, the conference call starts. I'm not listening. I'm just watching the shares. And the share price starts marching up from 11 to like 13, 14 during the call. Why? Because Rick's 125 clients are not smart, are not rich guys. They're Fidelity, Vanguard, they're Magellan, they're David Tepper, they're who knows, right? And so the thing marches up to the 20s, not by the end of the day, but within about 3 months. But I don't know why I own it. What am I supposed to do with this? So then I'm thinking, oh shit, I should sell what. So it's reunion weekend. So I go, oh, Rick will be at reunion. So we get to reunion weekend. I said, Rick, thanks for the tip. What do I do now? he starts going into his analyst mode. He's going, well, you know, blah, 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 cash flow this and this and this, and he's boring the shit out of me. And then he says, you know, it wouldn't hurt to take profits. Wouldn't hurt to take profits. Monday morning, I sell it all. I just jettison the whole wad. And here's the funny part. From Monday morning, 9 o'clock, it starts marching down. And over the weeks, it goes all the way back down to 11 from 20-something. And I believe to this day that my asking him, what do I do, caused him to go back to the office, walk by his secretary and say something like, hey, tell our preferred clients to start liquidating some of their Rational Software. And so then I call him. I said, should I buy it back? And he says, no. I'm thinking, what is this shit? What kind of game are we playing?
If he loved it at 11, how come he doesn't love
this
it at 11?
I was a tech bull. I loved this stuff, but I didn't know what I was doing. So he says, no. And then it went up fourfold. I'm not a trader. I'm not a trader.
Yeah, you give yourself a lot of fucking brain damage if you try to trade. That's what I've learned.
Well, some guys are okay at it, I guess, but I figure there's a survivorship bias. I figure the guys who did well are the ones who are considered good, right? I think we're being fooled by randomness at some level, unless you're one of these algo-toting
companies. I think
the
problem is, Dave, you don't hear about the guys that fucking go tits up and go bust.
Oh, you don't at all.
You hear the stories about the Peter Lynches. You know what I mean? You hear the stories about the guys that not the 100 other fund managers that Fidelity backed at the time that they backed the Magellan Fund. You know, all those guys.
Magellan.
What's
that? Peter Lynch's Magellan Fund was massaged into position. So when they started Magellan, they made sure it had all the best stuff because they were getting it ready to market it.
Right.
So they made sure that they tucked the right stuff in there, and they probably did illegal shit where they said, oh, this went way up. Let's take that and back that right into the Magellan and give it credit. And then what? They turned Magellan into the biggest fund in the world
It's the
because
same,
it has such a great track record.
it's the same thing about traders, like you're saying. You know, you hear the success. It's the same thing about sports gamblers. You only hear the success stories. Same thing about the lottery winners. You know, you're not watching 15,000 degenerates go to the Wawa and scratch off the fucking dollar tickets one day at a time.
Yeah, your dream, right? It's like the guys standing up there at the Academy Awards holding the trophy, shaking it, saying, "Follow your dream." And I'm going, "Yeah, like the 10,000 actors who are starving to death."
Follow your dream, right? I mean, that's
exactly
the lottery is a fascinating, fascinating experiment in human psychology.
Well, that's so mathematically stupid.
Go ahead.
When I walk into a convenience store and I see some guy who's got dirty overalls and he's buying two packs of cigarettes and lotto tickets, I'm going, "Oh my God. What are you doing, right? What are you doing?"
I got friends that do that. That's my friend in the overalls. You know that? But yeah, it's always been fascinating to me. But like, admittedly, you know, that was something I learned the hard way also too. I mean, I was that guy that went and played the lottery when I was in my 20s, you know, because you don't know math, you know. You don't figure out that
the house
always wins for a reason, right?
Yeah, the other thing I've heard is that, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I've heard that if you look at the indices and you do the math, you say, this is how much you make. I've read several accounts that say no one gets that. And I don't know where the frictional losses are, but no one gets. And so they think, well, I didn't do as well as I thought I'd do, but I did fine, you know, as the S&P goes up. But supposedly no one's getting those headline, you know, lower left, upper right slopes that they're supposed to be getting.
When you're busy, Maj, the guy that I work for at Geo Investing, has this article that he's always given to people, that some speech by Lauren Templeton, where she points out that people that are active that go in and try to, you know, catch those peaks and valleys, they wind up doing substantially worse than the people that just, you know, throw their money in a fucking ETF and then they go play cards for 20 years.
But let's say the S&P goes up 300% and you own the S&P.
Right.
Do you capture that 300% or not? Or are there hidden fees that make you not get there?
Oh, I'm sure there's fees, right? I mean, look at your checking account. Go back and look at the fees that you've paid in your checking. You want to be pissed off? First off, I mean, you go back and look at your trading commissions. Even if you're not an active trader, just go back and take a look at your commissions tonight and then see how you feel after that. But if you really want to get pissed off, if you really want to get ticked off, go into your fucking bank statement. There's usually a little search field that they let you query on your online statement. And just type in the word fee, F-E-E, and just see what pops up. Just see what pops up over the last 12 months.
I don't want to do it. I'm not going to do it.
Because they
not doing it.
Dave.
I got several settlements, presumably, you know, one out of Fidelity, maybe one out of TIA or CREF, one of those things. And I got these settlement checks because presumably they cheated us. And then there was a class action suit, and then they sent me a check. Yeah. And I did the math, and I got something like 0.002% of the assets worth of a check.
Right.
I'm thinking, but wait a minute. Nobody does a class action suit for 0.002% gain. So where did it all go? And the answer is not my wallet.
It went to the lawyers. I mean, look, everybody.
But it went.
Go ahead.
It's a snake pit out there. So
the lawyers in these class action suits are not worried about getting tangible, you know, reparations and recourse for the people that have gotten their ass kicked. They're worried about getting their fees. This is another type of, you know, what you're saying. Are you capturing the benefit of the class action, or are you just the, you know, the pawn that's being used by somebody else who's really capturing the fee? And yeah, you apply
yeah, like
that.
The 187 million a fine against Wells Fargo for cheating, what, 5 million customers.
Yeah, where are they going to come up with 187 million, Dave?
Yeah, I know.
Oh my God.
It's a near-death experience.
Robert Klein used to have you know the comedian Robert Klein?
Yep.
Yeah, he used to, one of his things, he's talking about something like that. You know, they fined him $5 million, he says. You know, they must have just absolutely racked the board of directors on that one. You know, where are we gonna come up with $5 million? What are we going to do?
Well, So, you know, when they gave the banks a bunch of freebies during the crisis, and then later on they fined them, I keep having this passing thought that it's even possible that the whole plan was to give him a ton of money and then fine it back.
Right.
And the whole thing was built in. It reminds me one time my kids wanted to play poker. So I made them do yard work all over for a couple hours, and then I gave them rolls of pennies, and then I won it all back from them. And so I got free yard work out of it. Right? So I've been wondering if the fines weren't just to retrieve the money they gave.
Of course it is. I mean, you don't think they worked that into their models?
It might have been preordained. It might have been the plan. Look, we're going to give you a ton of money, and then we're going to fine it back, and the people will think we got you, and everything will be fine, right?
Of course it's
preordained. You notice this paper written by Romer and Akerlof in 1994, in which they say that the entire banking system's model is to make money on the way up and then scoop up all the goodies on the way down from the bailouts. That's their business model, to make money going in both directions.
Of course it is.
Well, but it's just appalling that we kind of know that it's okay, but that it happens that way. But the idea that it's built into their models, it's just, we should hang some bankers in Times Square.
It most certainly is in their business model. If you don't think that there are, fields in Excel spreadsheets that are populated with what the potential risk is in terms of fines for breaking certain laws, of course, it's their business.
Right.
It's their business.
I once did the math on
a couple
of
guys, Dave.
About 3% of their earnings. 3% of their earnings were taken in the fines.
Dave, it's like guys that go out and run penny stock scams, and they cash out $30 million worth of stock, and the SEC fines them $500. Look at Lou Pye from Enron. All right? Lou Pye cashed out $500 million.
I don't know Lou Pye. Like, tell me that. What happened?
Lou Pye was the little Asian guy who everybody called the CEO behind the CEO. He was one of the executives, right? You had Skilling and you had Lay. And there's a reason you don't know Lou Pye. He was this, quiet guy that sat up in the office somewhere by himself. And there was this air and cloak of mystery around Lou Pye. The only thing anybody knew about him was that he had a penchant for strippers. He loved strippers. He was constantly going to the strip club. He had a ton of Enron. You got to look him up. He had a ton of Enron stock. He sold it all, whatever the window was in order to charge him for insider trading, whatever they got Skilling and Lay on, Lou Pye was like fucking 6 days outside that window. He dumped like $500 million in fucking Enron stock. And when the company went under, he got nothing. He paid I think he paid like a $30 million fine to the SEC. And that's it. And then he just took his $400 million, just like Dick Fold, and he just went and fucking mingled somewhere. And this guy's out there. And not only that, but I read an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago that now that Skilling's out of prison, who did he go to for financing? He went to fucking Lou Pye. The guy's giving him money. It's like, what the fuck is going on?
I miss that.
I can't believe you don't know who Lou Pye is.
And then we find, first and foremost, what's noticeable about Enron is that Andy Fastow did not set up the off-balance sheet accounts. Andy Fastow was not qualified to. The banker set them up for him. None of them went to prison. And then you find out that Madoff was known to be running a Ponzi scheme by, I think it was J.P. Morgan. For years, they knew it. And what was their response? Charge him high fees.
Right.
That's it. So why aren't the executives who knew about this, why aren't they drawn and quartered and fed to the fish?
Well, auditors do the same thing, right?
I mean,
one of the reasons that one of the red flags people always point out, why am I looking at this company as a potential fraud? What are the red flags? Well, what are their audit fees compared to similarly sized companies in the same industry? Are they in line with their peers, or are they fucking six times what their peers pay? And is it a $30 million market cap company paying $10 million in audit fees? Because
it's just bribes.
That's exactly what it is. And if you go back and you look at a lot of the U.S. listed China based frauds that had been uncovered, by Geo Investing, by Carson Block at Muddy Waters, by Kerrisdale, even Citron, 10 years ago when they started going after these reverse takeovers, one of the things that was always consistent about all of them was they always paid off their auditors. They always had these humongously high audit fees. It's the same fucking thing. It's the same thing with the rating agencies in 2008. I mean,
right.
It's just...
It's money laundering.
I don't know what it is. It's a cesspool is really what it is.
You know, and you got these horror stories like, so BCCI, the banker to the CIA, the banker to the drug lords, the banker to the dictators, 12th largest bank in the world, and then all of a sudden there's these big scandals and the whole thing unfolds. All those clients ran off to other banks, and then you start hearing stories about HSBC where they're actually changing their drive-through windows and putting in bigger windows so that boxes of money can be stuffed through the drive-through window and stuff like that, right? And nothing happens to HSBC. HSBC is just a new acronym for BCCI, best I can tell.
There was a great article the other day about the casinos in Vancouver and how they're not doing as well as people thought that they would be doing. Of course, Vancouver, you know, had that giant influx of money from
Chinese money,
right? Exactly, plowing into the real estate market. But they found out that once they introduced some regulations where these rich Asian people were no longer allowed to carry $2 million into the casino in a book bag and plop down at a table somewhere and say, hello, you know, can you make this into chips and then can you make it back into cash for me, please? Once they put in some regulations in place, the casinos were floored to find out that business had slowed down, right? It's the same thing.
Yeah, I also always wondered if maybe casinos weren't being used for political donations where you as a donor who's conflicted goes to a casino, drops a couple of million. The casino owner then turns around and donates that money in some way. I've always wondered if.
Oh, of course. Do you ever see the movie Casino?
No.
Oh, all right. Well, that's one of the politicians in the movie. I haven't seen it in years, but
Well,
they bring in one of the senators, right? And they put him up in the Tangiers. They put him up in the suite, all right? And they give him a couple of hookers. And he goes and I think he blows 50 grand or 100 grand at the table. And I think they make him whole on whatever he loses. Right. So that's a good way to do it. Hey, if you win, we'll let you take the money. And if you lose, we'll fucking make you whole again. You play with the house
money.
Sounds
like cattle future trading.
Right? Exactly. I mean, do you think that's what happened with Hillary Clinton and the cattle futures thing?
Yeah, I think so. She had the audacity of saying she was lucky.
I read that.
Yeah. There's a crook for you.
She's the world's best. Dave, she's the world's best cattle futures trader. Did anybody know
right.
that?
She did 100 bagger on cattle futures.
She is
100 bagger.
She is seven standard deviations in the fucking right direction, right? She's the Magellan Fund of cattle futures trading.
Well, there aren't seven standard deviations in the other direction, right?
No, just one. Just one.
There's
even
one standard deviation. I don't know. What do you call it when everyone ends up there?
Broke as fuck.
Yeah.
She's the best cattle futures trader in the world, and here she is just fucking around with politics. You know, with God-given talent like that, wouldn't you wanna dedicate yourself to your craft?
Yeah, she has a gift. Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, this seems like a good stopping point, but what I want is, if it's all right with you, I'd love to have you back in maybe like a month or so, or maybe the next time some crazy shit happens.
Yeah, we can talk.
And
we can
clear the air again and try to rack our brains and make ourselves a little bit less insane. You know, this is nice. Right. This is like therapy. I should be paying you hourly for this.
Yeah, or vice versa. Yeah. A couple of crotchety old bastards.
Yeah. Ben. Well, listen, Dave, I appreciate you so much coming on again, man. And, you know, if everybody doesn't follow you on Twitter, last time you were on, I didn't want to, I was pissed because I forgot to give your Twitter handle. It's at David B. Collum, C-O-L-L-U-M, and I'm going to put it in the podcast description. You know, just if you're triggered easily, you might want to avoid it. But otherwise, you might enjoy it.
And get professional help, too.
All right, my man. Thank you so much, Dave Collum. Great talking to you, brother.
Adios.
All right. Bye-bye. That was the one, the only Dave Collum. Back again. Man, I love that dude. Can't wait to have him back. Probably about a month or so. Right now, I got a couple of great guests lined up for the next week. But that's enough for today. I'm on an hour 40. Phillies baseball's on in about 1 hour. I'm going to go take care of that. And I am the fuck out of here. Thank you guys so much for listening to my patrons. Appreciate your support. Again, I am out. Peace.